News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Good evening. Today is Monday, July 23rd. I'm Chirag Mahajan. And you're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca. Good evening. It is 5:05 and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. And to show our support for them, we will also have a replay of our talk with Cara Byrne and Leanne Fava from the Affinity Project. All this plus your weekly health segment, this time on alcoholic beverages and what you should know about how much to consume per week. And your week day weather forecast right here on News 101. And to start our show, we go straight to Claire's interview with the Affinity Project.
Leanne Fava and Cara Byrne are the two young women behind the Affinity Project, a challenge that is seeing the pair compete in 8 charity challenges around the world. They're doing this all while battling MS themselves, but raising awareness and funds for MS isn't their only goal. In fact, it's taken a backseat to the bigger picture that they have in mind. In the words of Leanne and Cara, Affinity is about those who are beating the odds in life, who are in love with life, or who are simply fighting for more life. Their goal is to make every struggle a triumph, and so for more insight into this, we talk to them in our studio. I'm here today with Leanne Fava and Cara Byrne, who are working on the Affinity Project. So girls, can you tell me a bit about that and what it is?
Yeah, Cara and I will be doing an 8-episode series. So we're going to do 8 different charity challenges around the world for 8 different charities. Everything from running the New York City Marathon on the Michael J. Fox team for Parkinson's to, in 8 weeks, we're climbing the Great Wall of China for juvenile diabetes.
Wow, and what motivated you guys to do this and take on this project?
Well, Leanne and I both have MS, so when we met a year ago working at Bell and we discovered that, we decided to do something bigger than ourselves because of it. And yeah, kind of started developing the idea in January, and I'll be taking off in 55 days.
Wow, that's really exciting, and I think it's really cool that you guys both have MS and you're doing all these different charity challenges that really bring attention to a lot of different medical conditions around the world. So what was motivating you particularly to go after all these different medical issues that people faced?
One of the things that Cara has often said and taught me is that there's powers, you know, in numbers. So we want to champion our own disease as well as break down the barriers that segregate people with different diseases. So it's not just about MS or just about Parkinson's or cystic fibrosis. It's a movement, it's a global movement towards wellness. So it's not specifically to find a cure for one disease, it's so that we can all not just survive this life but live it spectacularly well.
Yeah. Sounds great. And what kind of response have you guys had so far just working on the project?
An overwhelming one, actually. When we launched the website and the Facebook page and the video, we had to actually turn our phones off because they were kind of going crazy on us from the response to it. But it's still spreading and still moving, and we need all the support that we can get to make
this happen, but the response has been great so far.
That's fantastic. And you guys mentioned that you're going off to do the Great Wall of China in 55 days, is it?
We actually start our first one in Kamloops.
Okay.
We're doing the 12-kilometer bike tour for the MS Society of Canada.
Okay.
And that one's important because Kara doesn't know how to ride a bike. And again, we're filming the whole thing, doing 8 episodes. So we start filming on Friday. She's going to begin the learning process of riding a bike. So helmets and knee pads, shin pads, and all that fun stuff. From Kamloops, then we head over to China, and we do the Great Wall of China to raise money for juvenile diabetes. And the great thing about all of these different challenges that we get to do every single one with someone who has the disease that we're championing.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a young man coming with us who has juvenile diabetes. We're going to skydiving London on my 25th birthday for the Cystic Fibrosis Trust with a young man who has CF, who's had a transplant, and he's going to hurl himself through the sky with us.
Yeah. What kind of learning outcomes do you expect for both yourselves and then for people who are watching these episodes or following you guys?
I think something we're learning is that if you set the example, you set the bar, people will follow, which you're never really sure when you take a chance, take a risk like this. But the following that we've had has been really incredible. And I think we're just hoping to teach other people about Finity, about what that is. So recognizing the finite existence that you have and using that to motivate yourself. That's what we're hoping to teach people.
And that you can push yourself. We're learning how to push ourselves and what our capacity is and keep pushing those limits.
Okay.
And one of the things that we've learned every day since we started this project, as we learn everybody else's stories, is that human capacity for greatness.
Mm-hmm.
And while we learn it in ourselves and other people get inspired by that, their stories are just phenomenal.
Do you have any in particular that stick out to you that you want to share?
Oh,
our first episode.
So many incredible people. Yeah, Tristan.
Yeah.
Yeah, we met this. Oh, he was so great. We did the 24-hour hockey tournament, and we met this little guy, Tristan, who just wants to be a goalie more than anything in the world. But he can't go on the ice because he is at risk of having a seizure, so it's not safe for him.
Mm-hmm.
But he showed up like full hockey gear, goalie mask, everything, and did his interview with us dressed like that, and we could barely hold his attention because he's just eyes on the ice the whole time, and he was really hilarious. Yeah,
we got to play road hockey with him after.
Yeah.
He plays road hockey once a week as a goalie.
Mm-hmm.
And that 24-hour hockey marathon, that was for the Rink of Dreams, so that was our first that was the kickoff for Finity.
Mm-hmm.
So Kara and I played, and it was to raise money for the Helpful Dream Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a Vancouver Island based charity to help families that have children that are facing life-threatening illnesses.
Okay.
So Tristan got to go to Disneyland when he was going through quite a hard time, or they provide assistive equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And so the stories, that was our first time actually experiencing these families and their stories and the humor they used to get through, their struggles. Mm-hmm. So
I guess you guys talked a bit about the meaning of the Finity Project and why you chose that, and I think maybe when people first hear it, it does sound a bit sad, like, because thinking about the affinity of life, but I think the way you spent it, of course, like, focusing on how, like, everyone was important and, like, really living for the now, just maybe can you go into that a bit more and why you were inspired to pick that as a name?
Yeah, I mean, well, to start, I was, 3 years ago, I was sitting in a film class, and my prof, we'd watched a movie that actually addressed the topic of death, and we were talking about it, and he said that it's really sad the way that everybody kind of walks around really unaware of their finite amount of time on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And it shouldn't be something that we are sad about, because it's a reality everybody will face at some
mm-hmm.
point. When we don't, none of us really know that. I think we assume that we're going to have, you know, days and days and days, and we just never know, or that you're going to be healthy your whole life. And maybe you will be, but it shouldn't, the idea of that shouldn't, you shouldn't waste time.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? You just never know where you're going to, what's going to happen. So
I think because it's not meant to be morbid, it's meant to be exciting. There are a lot of things that have prompted Kara and I to wake up each day.
Mm-hmm.
We've said before, life is what wakes you up in the morning. Infinity.
Mm-hmm.
The awareness of that of your own finite existence is what gets you out of bed.
Mm-hmm.
And Kara and I have both gone blind a couple times. I had heart surgery six years ago, and my heart stopped a couple times. So
when you can say, like, no, I've died twice, I've gone blind a couple times, like, those things, Kara's learned how to walk again, I've learned how to walk again, we've had these, when you wake up in the morning, you're already on the plus side of things.
Yeah.
So it spurs us to do this kind of stuff and show people that, man, there's so much out there that we can do and will do and we're excited to do.
And I think even if you live, you know, to 85 to 100, you should have 85 spectacular years. It shouldn't be, you know, that, well, I'll do things later. You should do everything you want to do now. I think it's really important.
Yeah, for sure. So that's a great message for people to hear and to remember. So if people want to support your campaign a little more, how can they get involved or follow you or watch these episodes?
Well, we are on Facebook, and social media is... This project wouldn't have been possible a few years ago, but social media is definitely helping us. So check out the Finity Project on Facebook. Like us, share us. We've got some videos up there of our... A trailer of our first episode and a promotional video that we did. We also have a campaign on Indiegogo, and that is what is going to be helping us fund this project, because the overall 8 different tracks, it's going to cost Kara and I to do them all about just over $30,000, with over 20,000 of that going to charity.
Right.
So our operational costs are really small, but to fund some of those operational costs, we've started this campaign on Indiegogo.
Mm-hmm.
So you can look up the Finity Project on there.
Yeah, I mean,
Twitter.
And we've got Twitter. We've got a Tumblr blog that's starting up soon, so you can follow our adventures there as well.
Awesome.
And as far as the episodes go, we are in contact with a couple different networks right now. And yeah, we'd love to be able to tell you that, hey, as of January, this is where you'll be able to see us, but we're waiting to figure out which channel we'll be featured on.
That's awesome. It sounds like you guys definitely have a great project going and pretty inspiring, so best of luck to you both.
Once again, that was Leanne Fava and Kara Byrne from the Finity Project talking a bit about their project, their ideology, and what they're doing. So if you want any more information, you can check out their website, thefinityproject.com, and we will be keeping you updated on how their search for a spot on TV and as well as film will be going, as well as an update on how they're doing on the project. So do keep listening for ongoing info. For News 101, I'm Claire Eagle.
And thank you to Claire Eagle for that interview with Kara Byrne and Lee Ann Fava of the Infinity Project. And that does it for your local headlines. We're going to take a quick break, but do stay with us for your provincial and national headlines, as well as your weekday weather forecast and your health segment. This is CITR 101.9 FM.
Vancouver Frontrunners' 8th Annual Pride Run and Walk kicks off Pride Week, Saturday, July 28th, 2012. This 10-kilometer run, 4-kilometer walk in Stanley Park raises money for local charity Out in Schools, bringing awareness and fighting bullying and homophobia in primary and secondary schools in Canada. Register as a team or individual for this fabulous event with incredible prizes for top finishers and the largest, fastest, and best-dressed teams. Join MLAs and all of your friends at the largest Pride Run and Walk ever. Support a great cause and have a blast. For more information or to register, visit www.vancouverfrontrunners.org. Queer FM Vancouver Reloaded and CITR 101.9 FM are proud media partners and supporters of the Pride Run and Walk.
The alphabet has only 26 letters. With these 26 magic symbols, however, millions of words are written every day.
This month in Discorder, check out part 2 of our summer festival preview, which indulges you in the folky, the hippie, the eclectic, and the electronic. Discorder sits down with Hot Panda to talk about things like hot sauce, writing food blogs, and the ultimate battle for panda greatness. We also talk with the V Vecker Ensemble, who are the Captain Planet of Vancouver indie music. We talk with Ryan Smith of Green Burrito Records of the value of cassette tapes, and experience Sasquatch Music Festival through the eyes of Discorder. Don't forget to check out our regular columns like Filmstrip, where we review the film Better Than Something. Check out our events calendar for all the greatest upcoming shows, and our art project focusing on the work of Aaron Moran. You'll find the greatest in both recorded and live music in our Under Review and Real Life Action sections. All this and more in the July issue of Discorder, that magazine from CITR, on stands now.
And welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. We're broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. It is now time for your provincial and national headlines. But first, a quick update on the security staff union and their one-day-long legal strike here at the UBC. On a ruling released on Friday, the Labor Relations Board has ruled that last week's day-long strike by COPE378, the security staff union, was legal. Union representative Dave McPherson said the one-day picket was an effort to keep their strike mandate active. The union passed a unanimous strike vote on March 6th, giving them the option of calling a strike within a 90-day period. However, in the email sent out to staff before the strike, the AMS was under the impression that the 90-day time limit for a strike had expired, since the strike vote occurred on March 5th. In response to the AMS's questioning of the strike's legality, COPE378 argued that the 90-day time limit on declaring a strike was put on hold during the dispute's 2.5 months of mediation. The ruling now states that the AMS is no longer contesting the legality of the strike. In response to the Labor Relations Board ruling, AMS President Matt Parson said that the AMS wasn't sure about the legality of the strike when the email was sent, saying, quote, "We never had any intention of implementing any disciplinary measures regardless," end quote. He also said, quote, "At that point, there was no ruling on it, so we weren't taking a stance, but merely raising a point that there is a high likelihood that it potentially could be unlawful," end quote. Jarrah Hodge, a spokesperson for COPE378, said that although the AMS's email didn't seriously concern her, she found it frustrating. Hodge said, quote, "They were putting out that information that wasn't correct while we were trying to focus on our issues," end quote. According to Hodge, the AMS has invited the union back to the bargaining table, and new negotiation dates will be set for late August or early September. And now back to our provincial and national headlines. The provincial government of British Columbia finally unveiled their stance on the proposed Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipeline project, but critics say it's just more fence-sitting. Environment Minister Terry Lake announced Monday that the government would support future heavily oil pipelines only if 5, quote, minimum requirements, end quote, are met. The conditions include successful competition, completion of the National Energy Board Joint Review Panel, developing world-leading oil spill response, and mitigating the cost of cleanup for both marine and land disasters. Third, meeting legal requirements regarding Aboriginal and treaty rights. And four, ensuring BC receives a, quote, fair share of the fiscal and economic benefits of the pipeline. Environment Minister Terry Lake said the province won't stand for the project if BC doesn't get a share of the profits. According to the ministry's estimates, BC stands to gain just 8% of the fiscal benefits from the pipeline, despite shouldering 100% of the risk to marine environments and 58% of the risk on land. And while Minister Lake said a dollar figure hasn't been ironed out, the current financial gain for BC isn't good enough. Grand Chief Stuart Phillip, president of the Union of BC Indian Chiefs, said the majority of BC's First Nations remain opposed to Northern Gateway. He said, quote, "No amount of minuscule increases to safety or a provincial policy paper that ultimately allows the Christie Clark government to approve the proposed pipeline provide any assurances that the land and waters will be protected," end quote. BC NDP leader Adrian Dix, whose party is officially opposed to the pipeline, says the conditions of clearing environmental assessment and respecting treaty rights must be legally met for the project to continue, regardless of whether the province insists or not. Two prominent Canadian doctors have joined an international campaign calling on world leaders to stop the spread of AIDS by ending the so-called war on drugs. Their advertising campaign is being launched today and is endorsed by supporters of the 2010 Vienna Declaration, which urges governments to write evidence-based drug policies. The campaign has a specific message for US President Barack Obama and Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney, saying, quote, "You can't end AIDS unless you end the war on drugs. It's dead simple," end quote. The campaign is being launched as delegates meet this week at a major international AIDS conference in Washington. Among those asking world leaders to show qualities like leadership and courage and the foresight to do the right thing are British billionaire Richard Branson, the former presidents of Brazil and Colombia, and BC-based AIDS specialist doctors Evan Wood and Julio Montaner. Dr. Evan Wood, who is the lead researcher at the BC Center for Excellence in HIV/AIDS and chair of the Vienna Declaration, said, quote, "I think people are really starting to question the war on drugs. I think globally we're seeing a real shift in terms of public opinion and a recognition that addiction should be treated more as a health issue rather than a criminal justice issue," end quote. Dr. Evan Wood said that while HIV infection rates are falling around the globe, the number of cases appear to be rising in countries with aggressive policies for prosecuting drug-related crimes. He argues the war on drugs actually helps spread HIV in several ways. Dr. Wood has said that, so far, the war on drugs has cost the US economy more than $1 trillion, and each case of AIDS can cost the Canadian taxpayer about $500,000 in medical costs. When asked how successful the new campaign is likely to be in convincing American political leaders, Dr. Evan Wood noted that economic times are tough and some states are now spending more money on incarceration than on education. Thousands of students and their supporters have once again taken to the streets of Montreal on Sunday to denounce the province's tuition increases, sending a message they will be ready for a fight if Premier Jean Charest decides to call an election. It has been widely speculated that Premier Jean Charest may call an election on August 1st for a vote in early September. Protests against Quebec's Liberal government have eased during the summer months, but students said a strong turnout during the height of the summer holidays was proof the movement hasn't died out. The crowd, an enthusiastic mix of students, families, and seniors, winded its way through the city's downtown on a hot and humid afternoon. Class, spelled C-L-A-S-S-E, which organized the march, has promised it won't support one particular party, but will work to make sure the Liberals don't return to power. Other student groups are also planning an information campaign explaining their opposition to the tuition increases. While some student leaders said tuition hikes remain the main point of disagreement, the movement has taken on a wide range of issues, including the government's environmental and economic policies. Many remain upset about Bill 78, the provincial law introduced in May that suspended school for striking students and put limits on some protests. The province's Human Rights Commission released a report last week saying portions of the law infringe on fundamental rights and violate the Quebec Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Provincial funding for a police anti-violence initiative was made permanent on Monday as Toronto grappled with a series of recent public shootings that have left multiple people dead. Premier Dalton McGuinty announced that Ontario will earmark $12.5 million for several initiatives aimed at preventing more violence, with the money coming from existing sources in the provincial budget. The majority of the funding, $7.5 million, will go towards the provincial anti-violence intervention strategy. The remaining $5 million will be allocated to the program in Toronto, which has led to nearly 22,000 arrests since its creation in 2006. The two employ a total of 72 uniformed officers, specially trained to prevent and quickly respond to high-risk police calls, including gang-related incidents. The funding will ensure that the programs will continue into the future, said Premier McGuinty. He admitted the government was considering putting the money up on the chopping block when it was set to expire this year because of the $15 billion provincial will go toward area police forces and the provincial police. The funds will also be used to provide additional support to local community groups. And those are our provincial and national headlines here on News 101. Up next, we have your weekly health segment brought to you by our health team, Dietetics Intuition.
Welcome to your weekly health beat on CITR 101.9 FM.
It's Dietetic Intuition, your source for precise nutrition advice.
What are you going to hear? We'll bust nutrition myths, give tips, do book reviews, as well as interviews, you name it. And now here are your dietetic students, Andrea, Jessica, and Sharon, for this week's segment.
Hi, everyone. So today we're talking about alcoholic beverages. And, you know, since the sun is out, people are having a good time going out on the patio every once in a while, we often get the question, can alcoholic beverages be part of a healthy diet? And we want to clarify that we're talking about drinks that have alcohol, anything above 0.5%. If you notice, sometimes in the grocery store you might see non-alcoholic beer or something like that, and those are usually 0.5 or lower. So another question you may have is, how much should I be drinking per day? And there are some guidelines developed by the Canadian Centre of Substance Abuse. Basically, they're developed to reduce long-term health risks. So for women, it's 1 to 2 drinks per day, and that equals about 10 drinks per week. But the point is that you should have it gradually throughout the week and not binge drink on, you know, Friday or Saturday night. And then for men, it's just a little bit more at 2 to 3 drinks per day. Again, no more than 15 drinks per week. And so now I'm just going to talk about what is one drink of alcohol. So for a 5% alcohol drink, which is anything like beer, cider, or cooler, which is a little bit less alcohol and lighter, it's a 12-ounce serving. And then for a glass of wine, which is a 12% alcohol, 5 ounces is the serving size. And then for a little bit of the harder stuff, spirits like rye, gin, rum, that's a 40% alcohol content, and it's a 1.5-ounce serving, so like a shot glass. So, yeah, that's what it is. And then Andrew's going to talk about how this all affects your body.
Okay, so alcohol is actually absorbed two ways in your body. 20% is absorbed through your stomach and 80% is absorbed through your small intestine. And this is important to note because that means that your blood alcohol concentration can change significantly within only about 20 minutes of drinking. Now, how fast the alcohol is absorbed depends on a couple things. First of all, the concentration of alcohol you're drinking. Basically, the greater the concentration, the faster the absorption. The type of drink that you're drinking. Carbonated beverages tend to speed up absorption. And whether or not you're drinking on a full stomach, because eating food tends to slow absorption. Now, what are some health concerns around drinking alcohol? First of all, it's a diuretic, which means that it can be dehydrating. Make sure that when you're drinking alcohol, make sure to drink tons of water while you're at it. It's also quite fattening at 7 kilocalories per gram. As a reference point, carbs are only 4 kilocalories per gram, and fat is only 9 kilocalories per gram. So alcohol is basically empty calories if you think about it. It doesn't have the vitamins, the minerals, or the fiber that eating whole foods provides. Drinking alcohol can also lead to some liver diseases in the long run because it's mainly processed by your liver. So, for example, cirrhosis, alcoholic hepatitis, etc. And lastly, some studies have shown that it can be carcinogenic, particularly the mouth, the throat, the esophagus, and the liver. So I will pass it off to Jess now, and she will be talking to you about whether or not having a drink occasionally can be healthy for you.
Alrighty, so our interesting Monday health facts surrounding this controversy of I've heard that drinking occasionally is healthy for me. Well, our response to this is some research suggests that having one drink a day can lower the risk of heart disease and diabetes in some middle-aged adults, and even those who avoid alcohol altogether are suggested to have a lower lifespan than people who drink one per day. Most notably, we see red wine in studies, as this is part of the Mediterranean diet, which has been shown to be extremely healthful. So red wine has a higher concentration of antioxidants than other alcoholic drinks, and it's been shown in some studies to,
protective effect on heart health, as it increases the concentration of good cholesterol, or HDL cholesterol, and this may be correlated with a longer lifespan. However, the possible health benefits decline with each additional drink. So the bottom line that we want to communicate with everyone is that alcohol can have some positive effect on your health, but there are other ways to surefire increase your health, such as eating more fruits and vegetables, drinking more water, and exercising more.
Thanks for tuning in again this week.
If you missed us, please go to blogs.ubc.ca/dietetics intuition or follow us on Twitter at CITR Health, and even like us on Facebook at Dietetics Intuition. Until next time, stay happy and healthy, Vancouver.
And thank you to our health team for that segment. You can listen to that segment once again if you'd like on our website, citr.ca/news. And now we have your weekday weather forecast brought to you by our very own weatherman, Phil Chang. How are you, Phil?
I'm doing great. Thank you, CJ.
It's good to hear you again. Hope you have a good week ahead.
Thanks. Well, here it goes. The week ahead looks to be one mostly of clouds with sun on Wednesday and Thursday, thankfully. On the forecast loop, we don't see many features of active weather, but a high-pressure system is hugging the coastline directly to the west of us. So the majority of our current active weather is coming in from the north-northeast direction, mostly consisting of scattered patches of clouds and cold air parcels. So the temperatures are a little bit below the average for this time of the year. Temperatures are expected to fluctuate around 20 degrees on most days. Feels like 18 with the little breeze that's going on. All right. Now here's your 5-day weekday weather forecast for Vancouver. Tonight, cloudy with 30% chance of showers. Early this evening, low of 13. Tuesday, mainly cloudy. Starts to become clear in the afternoon. High of 21. UV index of 7 or higher. Tuesday night, a few clouds, low of 15. Wednesday, sunny, high of 23. Thursday, also sunny, high of 24, low of 16. Friday, a mix of sun and cloud, high of 22, low of 16. Yeah, so that's your 5-day weekday weather summary, brought to you by Environment Canada. Reporting for News 101, I'm Phil Chang. I'm from the UBC Storm Club.
Thank you, Phil. That sounds good.
Thank you, CJ.
See you next week.
Hi.
Cheers. And thank you to Phil for that weekday weather forecast. We're going to take a quick break, but do stay with us for your international headlines and a really interesting interview with Subhankar Banerjee, conducted by Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! And yes, stay tuned.
Jazz is a word that means many different things to many different people. The best definition of jazz that I know of is the jazz show on CITR with yours truly, Gavin Walker. Monday nights, 9 to midnight, with the jazz feature at 11 o'clock. Check us out every Monday.
Union and Timber Concerts are pleased to present Yellow Wolf with Smack the River. The show takes place August 3rd at Fortune Sound Club. Doors are at 7 p.m. 19 plus only. Tickets are on sale now at Red Cat, Zulu, and Beat Street Records, or online at unionevents.com and timberconcerts.com. Don't make me go pop the
trunk. And welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. You can also listen to us online at citr.ca. You can also check out our past interviews on our website, citr.ca/news. Thank you for being with us. It is now time for your international headlines, brought to you by Democracy Now! And Amy Goodman.
Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Thousands gathered in Aurora, Colorado Sunday at a public vigil for the victims of the shooting rampage at a local movie theater. The toll stands at 12 dead, 58 wounded, 9 of them critically. After meeting with grieving families, President Obama said he'd brought a message of support on behalf of the country.
I confess to them that words are always inadequate in these kinds of situations, but that my main task was to serve as a representative of the entire country and let them know that we are thinking about them at this moment and will continue to think about them each and every day, and that the awareness that not only all of America but much of the world is thinking about them might serve as some comfort.
After 2 days of attempts, bomb squads were able to defuse the array of explosives left behind in the apartment of shooting suspect James Holmes. Police believe Holmes meticulously planned his rampage, spending thousands of dollars on weapons and ammunition that arrived in some 90 packages over the course of several months. Holmes' online purchases, done with a few keystrokes, included 3,000 rounds of handgun ammunition, 3,000 rounds for an assault rifle, and 350 shells for a 12-gauge shotgun. When police disabled his booby-trapped apartment, they found 30 improvised hand grenades and several containers filled with gunpowder and gasoline. At least 6 other firearms were also retrieved. According to witnesses, a higher death toll may have been avoided because Holmes' weapon jammed as he fired on the fleeing crowd. In the aftermath of the tragedy, the Obama administration's already ruled out a push to change the nation's gun control laws. On Sunday, White House Press Secretary Jay Carney told reporters, quote, "The president's view is we can take steps to keep guns out of the hands of people who should not have them under existing law." Holmes is currently being held in solitary confinement at an Aurora jail ahead of his first court appearance today. We'll host a roundtable on the Aurora shootings and past mass killings after headlines. Police in the California city of Anaheim are facing allegations of murder and brutality after fatally shooting 2 Latino men over the weekend and firing rubber bullets at crowds of protesters. On Saturday, Anaheim officers shot and killed 24-year-old Manuel Diaz after he reportedly ran away from a group of officers who confronted him in an alleyway. Diaz was unarmed. One witness reported Diaz had his back to the officers when he was shot in the buttocks. Police then allegedly fired another bullet through his head as he fell to the ground. 2 of Diaz's sisters demanded justice for their slain brother.
And once they even shot him in the leg and he went down, the cop continued and shot him in the head. Like, what is that about? My brother did not have a weapon on him at all.
And these cops need to know what they've done to us, to our family, especially my mom. And we're going to speak for him, and we're going to bring this to justice.
Hours after Diaz's death, a chaotic scene broke out when police fired rubber bullets and tear gas at a crowd of local residents protesting the shooting. A number of people were wounded, including several children. Video was taken of a police dog rushing a man trying to protect his infant child. More than 24 hours after Diaz's death, police shot dead another Latino resident in Anaheim, Joel Acevedo. Police say Acevedo was suspected in a car robbery. The circumstances around his death remain unconfirmed. Dozens of people have been killed in a spate of attacks across Iraq earlier today. At least 93 people are dead, along with 140 wounded from 19 separate bombings and shootings. At least 15 soldiers were killed when assailants struck a military base in the province of Saladin. It was the deadliest day of violence in Iraq this year. The Syrian government's claiming to have retaken a district of the capital, Damascus, after a week of clashes with rebel fighters. Witnesses reported seeing the execution of several people as Syrian troops conducted house-to-house searches. The violence came days after the rebels dealt a major blow to the Assad regime with the killing of four top officials in a suicide attack. At a meeting in Qatar, Arab League foreign ministers approved a call urging the resignation of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and offering him safe passage out of Syria. In Afghanistan, three U.S. military contractors were killed Saturday when a man dressed in an Afghan army uniform opened fire at a training camp in the province of Herat. It was the latest in a series of deadly shootings by apparent members of the Afghan forces against foreigners with the U.S.-led NATO occupation. Tens of thousands gathered at memorials in Norway Sunday to mark the first anniversary of the bombing and shooting rampage that left 77 people dead. The attacker, Anders Behring Breivik, set off bombs at government buildings in Oslo, killing 8 people before shooting dead 69 people, mainly young people, at a Labour Party youth camp. Most were teenagers. Breivik had said he targeted the ruling Labour Party because their policies were too open to Muslim immigrants. The head of the Labour Party's youth wing, Eskil Pedersen, said mourners had done their best to honor the victims.
So to come together to mark that it's been a year that has gone by is a special experience, but an important experience. And I think we did the best of it. We were together, which is important. We had the possibility to show your emotions, your feelings about what happened. And at the same time, we have the message that we have to continue living our lives.
Arguments in Anders Behring Breivik's trial came to a close last month, and a verdict is expected in late August. A major international conference on global AIDS policy opened in Washington, D.C. Sunday, the first time the event has been held on U.S. soil in 2 decades. Hundreds of people marked the conference's first day with a rally on the National Mall calling for cheaper antiretroviral drugs and greater international aid. At the conference's opening panel, Democratic Congressmember Barbara Lee of California called for a new push to help AIDS patients worldwide.
I think we must redouble our efforts, redouble our commitment to PEPFAR, to the Global Fund, to our domestic national HIV/AIDS strategy and plan, which I believe President Obama has so boldly put forward. That is the right thing to do. But it's been a bit quiet in this country, and we need to make some noise. We need to put eradicating HIV and AIDS at the front burner of our political agenda, both here and abroad.
The conference has drawn controversy from AIDS activists because of U.S. restrictions banning sex workers and drug users. The Obama administration's lifted a 20-year-old ban that prevented people infected with HIV from entering the country, but sex workers and drug users require a special waiver. At a satellite session with sex workers from other countries, Miriam Edwards of the Guyana Sex Workers called for broader acceptance of the sex trade.
We are a part of the general population. We need people to accept sex workers as the general population and stop segregating them as different. Sex workers are human beings and they must be accepted. If not, we will never get to zero on HIV.
Sex workers and their allies have protested their exclusion by holding a separate conference, the Sex Worker Freedom Festival, in Calcutta, India. At the conference's opening Saturday, Ruth Morgan Thomas of Global Network of Sex Work Projects said the event was being held to include the voices of marginalized sex workers.
The Sex Worker Freedom Festival, we've organized this because of the U.S. travel restrictions that prevent sex workers from all over the world going to the Washington AIDS Conference to participate, as we have done since 1988 when the conferences started. And we're here to talk about our rights as sex workers that are fundamental to us being able to end AIDS.
In Mexico, thousands of students marched against President-elect Enrique Peña Nieto Sunday after accusations of electoral fraud. Peña Nieto's critics have accused him of buying votes and rigging media coverage in his victory over second-place candidate Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Protester Jaime Sánchez Barrios said public protest is the only way to counter the Mexican media's bias toward Peña Nieto.
This is our only way to counter the manipulation of the media outlets. They own the television screens. They only say what is convenient to them. That's why people are here, those of us who aren't willing to conform, which is the majority, even if they do not want to recognize that. This is the only way we can make them feel our discontent and let them know we do not agree with what is happening, that they want to impose the next president.
Penn State has removed a now infamous bronze statue of the late head coach Joe Paterno following a scathing report that found him and other school officials covered up child molestation. A recent investigation found Paterno and three others hid the sexual molestation allegations against assistant coach Jerry Sandusky 14 years before they finally came to light. On Sunday, work crews removed a bronze statue of Paterno outside the school's football stadium. In a statement, Penn State said, quote, "Were it to remain, the statue will be a recurring wound to the multitude of individuals across the nation and beyond who've been the victims of child abuse." And Alexander Coburn, the longtime journalist, columnist, and publisher of the progressive website of news and analysis Counterpunch, has died at the age of 71. Alex Coburn was a prolific writer who authored columns over the years for The Village Voice, The Wall Street Journal, and The Nation magazine. In a 2007 interview with C-SPAN, Coburn said he believes liberal U.S. media pundits who back the U.S. invasion of Iraq should go to Baghdad to hear from the war's victims.
From 2003 to 2007, this country's gone, and people's lives irretrievably. I mean, millions of lives destroyed. It would have been better if they'd not gone in. So I'd like these people to be in Baghdad, you know, having to answer a few very serious questions from these poor women and family people constantly searching for, you know, their wrong. So I think I say at the end of that piece, it was the people accused of being the hard left or the left, and also the libertarians. We should not forget the libertarians, people like on antiwar.com, you know, who were against the war clearly and said this is a terrible idea.
Alexander Coburn, dead at the age of 71. To see our interviews with him, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And thank you to Amy Goodman for those international headlines. For a really interesting interview, we now go back to Democracy Now! For their interview with Mark Herzgaard, who is an environmental correspondent for The Nation and fellow at the New America Foundation. And he is here now with Democracy Now! To talk about why parents need to act against climate change for their kids' sake.
Suffers through its worst drought since the 1950s. A new report from the U.S. Drought Monitor shows nearly 60% of the country is now affected. About 1,300 counties have been designated drought disaster areas. The combination of heat and dryness has taken a major toll on corn and soybean crops. This is a farmer, Bob Bowman, who says his cornfields in and around Welton, Iowa look green, but his plants are less than half the height they should be.
This corn should be as high as my head right now. And it's waist high. It's been stunted because of the dry weather. It's early morning here, and the corn is relaxed and looks pretty nice. By 5 o'clock, if I was standing in this same spot, the corn would have a little bit of a gray cast to it, and it would be all rolled up tight.
Well, our next guest, Mark Herzgaard, looks at these conditions in a new article for the Daily Beast called Parents Need to Act Against Climate Change for Their Kids' Sake. He's author of Hot, living through the next 50 years on Earth. Mark is environment correspondent for The Nation, fellow at the New America Foundation, co-founder of this new group called Climate Parents, joining us from San Francisco. Mark Hertzgard, thanks so much for joining us back again here on Democracy Now! Talk about the climate that we are experiencing just in the United States alone now and what you're doing about it.
Well, that shot from Iowa reminds me of, I was just out doing reporting in Minnesota myself and talking to the farmers there. The quote that comes to mind is from a plant biologist at the University of Illinois who looked at the drought and the heat in hitting the farm belt of this country, and he said, "This is like farming in hell. We're going to see an enormous impact already on the agricultural output in this country." And, you know, we forget sometimes the United States is the world's leading agricultural superpower. But this summer, we're already seeing in the futures markets for corn and soybean prices are shooting up because of what's going to happen to the harvest. And let's remember what happened the last time that food prices went up around the world in 2008. We saw food riots in 12 countries that almost toppled governments. So these are some of the impacts that climate change can lead to. And we're just at the start of this also, unfortunately, which is why we've started Climate Parents, you mentioned. Thank you very much for that. Because our kids are the ones who are going to have to deal with this. The climate future that we are handing off to them is really, frankly, quite terrifying. And so to me, one of the things I asked in that Newsweek Daily Beast article is, why is it that parents aren't more involved in this? Why aren't we up in arms about it? And so we're starting this group, climateparents.org, as an effort to help parents find their voice on this issue. And I must say that the initial response to that article has been very gratifying. I've heard from literally scores of parents all across the country who are saying, yes, I have felt scared about what my kids are facing because of climate change, but I've also felt powerless and paralyzed, and I didn't know what to do. Well, we're going to try and change that, because at the moment, we think that parents are probably the single most underorganized constituency on climate change, which is pretty bizarre considering the threat that climate change poses to what all of us hold most dear in our lives, which is our kids. So we're going to find a way to change that.
Well, Mark, you also make the point that it's not a question of individual actions like recycling or your own individual efforts to beat back climate change, but it's the necessity of getting involved organized consumer actions.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Juan, because I think most people's response, especially when they're listening to the mainstream media, if they care about this, is, okay, well, what can I do? Well, maybe I can bicycle to work, or I'll take the kids on mass transit instead. And don't get me wrong, those are good first steps, if only because they make you think about how your own individual actions affect the collective future. But those things alone will never suffice. You've got to go after what are the main drivers of climate change, and those are government policies and corporate practices. We just spent the earlier part of this program looking at what Shell is going to do, wants to do in the Arctic. I was a little surprised that you didn't mention what Interior Secretary Salazar has said about that. When they asked him about the possibility of an oil spill, he says, well, I don't think there will be an oil spill. Somehow that's not very reassuring to me. Mm. We've got to change those kinds of practices. We've got to change the fact that right now there is no price on carbon pollution in this country. You are allowed to pollute, to put your waste into the atmosphere for nothing. And those are because of government policies that not only make it free, we actually subsidize Shell and ExxonMobil and Peabody Coal and all of these big fossil fuel companies. We subsidize them to wreck the planet for our kids.
Explain what you mean by that subsidy, Mark.
We spend billions and billions of dollars every year, including subsidizing these kinds of exploratory drilling. We subsidize the production of coal. We subsidize all of the highways that are used to consume that oil. If you actually look at the amount of subsidies, it's up in the billions of dollars. And this, by the way, is for the richest industry in history, the fossil fuel industry. Why are we doing that? Well, right now there are 60 members of Congress, senators, and the House of Representatives who signed on to a bill led by Keith Ellison in the House of Minnesota, who are calling, and I think Bernie Sanders of Vermont, who are calling for an end to those subsidies. If you can't get that through the Congress, I think that it's just a sign of how what a corporate control there is in Washington. But I will say that a lot of the environmental groups this fall are going to be pushing to ask your member of Congress, where do you stand on ending those subsidies? And that's one of the fights that we hope the climate parents will be involved with as well.
Well, Mark, over the past month, all across the United States, there were extreme weather events, the worst forest fires in Colorado history, a deadly mid-Atlantic storm that left 23 dead and 4 million without power, and a record-shattering heat wave across the East Coast and the Midwest. But amidst the news coverage of these extraordinary events, we didn't hear much in the media about global warming. This is just a sampling of some of the news reports at the time.
It's baked the Rockies and the Great Plains, now spreading east. There are 113 million Americans now in the excessive heat advisory zone. That's more than a third of the entire U.S. population.
The high today here in Indianapolis, a sizzling 103 degrees. That broke a 78-year-old record.
Nashville broke its all-time record, hitting 109 degrees. Authorities urged people to stay indoors and canceled outdoor events this weekend. From Atlanta,
smoking out here,
to Chicago.
I'm going to bring a towel soaked in ice and a bucket with ice and try to keep cool.
U.S. National Guard is helping police in Colorado Springs in the wake of the most destructive wildfires in the state's history. Those fires have forced thousands of people to flee their homes.
The fast-moving fires in Colorado have destroyed hundreds of homes and are threatening thousands more. The fires have grown so large, you can see it from space. Take a look at this video from the International Space Station. It shows the area scorched by flames in the western states so far.
It's getting quite dangerous for some people, very old and the very young especially. There's an excessive heat watch, which is basically an official way of telling you what we've been telling you for a long time. The rest of this week, lots and lots of excessive heat.
And Mark, you've made the point in your writings about previous deadly heat waves across Europe and the United States, and somehow the signs keep being ignored here in this country.
In this country, only the one. You know, we've had two, maybe three landmark heat waves in the history of man-made global warming. The first was 1988, which put global warming on the map when Jim Hansen, the NASA scientist, went to Congress and said, global warming's begun. The second was 2003 in Europe, where we lost 71,000 people in the space of 6 weeks died from that heat wave. But it also pushed the discussion in Europe forward, and government leaders began to recognize it and call for tougher policies. We will see if 2012 is going to be the third landmark heat wave, because it doesn't just require to become a landmark. It's not just about the meteorological conditions. It's about the political and the social reaction to it. And one of the things I really want to do is to call on my colleagues and the rest of the media who so far have been ignoring the climate signature on this heat wave of 2012. We have our own federal government scientists saying this is what global warming looks like. We need to start taking that seriously, and above all, we need our politicians to begin to talk about this. And I just want to, in particular, shout out to President Obama and Governor Romney. You are both parents. Start acting like it on the climate issue. We need you to show the kind of leadership, and all politicians to show the kind of leadership on this. This should not be a political issue. This is about protecting our children.
Mark Herkesgaard, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Environment correspondent for The Nation, fellow at the New America Foundation. His new article is on the Daily Beast. It's called Parents Need to Act Against Climate Change for Their Kids' Sake. We'll link to that at democracynow.org, and he's author of Hot: Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth.
And thank you to Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! For that interview with Mark Herkesgaard, founder of Climate Parents. And that's our program for July 23rd. Today's newscast is brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to contact us, you can email us at news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews on our website, citr.ca/news. Join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Sore Throats Clapping Hands with your host, Robert, right here on CITR 101.9 FM.